For those people here on 2094 and 2368, it appears the committee is not ready to move forward. There's some confusion on some of the amendments that did not come out of LC, apparently the way they were requested for one reason or another. So we're going to have to bring those back, and we will bring those back as soon as we get amendments that are wired together the way they're supposed to be. So we're going to start then a public hearing on 3426. We have Representative Barker. You're here first on this. This was your bill, and it's been pirated to some degree. I'll probably use a wrong term, but you want to come up and give your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee for wanting me to speak today. Occasionally, Mrs. Hill allowed me to speak on the other side. I just came in. This originally was a bill that, as you know, that I put out to bring us into line with the 1985 Supreme Court decision, Tennessee versus Gardner. And then now, with events, it's been amended and some good amendments to that bill. But I just have some concerns in that this thing seems to be going rather quickly all of a sudden. The grand jury system is really too important for anything other than very careful consideration if we're going to make changes to that. Legislation about deadly force investigation should be deliberate and considered and based on evidence received by the legislature. And we've only been considering this bill for a few weeks and the latest version just for a few days. The legislation impacts every police officer in Oregon, and we have an obligation to make sure that any sweeping legislation like this is thoroughly analyzed before it's enacted. And our whole goal, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think all of us agree that we want to make the streets safer for everybody. Some of my concerns about this have things to do, like the Attorney General's office.
Could you do me a favor?
I could.
And I hate to interrupt you, but could you address the initial issue, the 85 case that the bill was introduced
right.
for?
And
if you could talk about the amendment.
And I just realized I should say also for the record, I'm Representative Jeff Barker, House District 28. The original bill came out of a case, Tennessee versus Gardner, which was a 1985 Supreme Court case. And what happened in that case, there was a 14-year-old burglar who was running from a house, unarmed burglar, climbing a fence, and the police shot and killed him. And the Tennessee laws, as do the Oregon laws, or did the Oregon laws, said that that was okay at that time. You could shoot a fleeing felon. And when I was I joined the Oregon State Police in 1970. That was the law of Oregon at that time. It was still the law when I joined the Portland Police Bureau in 1974, although the Portland Police Bureau by that time had said, even though the law says you can do this, you can't. We have more restrictive rules and regulations, and it has to be a threat to life before you can take a life. So many police agencies are already ahead of that, but the department, what used to be called the Bureau of BPSC, Bureau of Standards and Training, which is now the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, until 1999 was still teaching that it was okay to shoot a fleeing felon. So that was the purpose of my original bill, was to get us in line, set the tone, set the level a little higher, the benchmark a little higher, just for middle.
Senator Burdick.
Is it what you're saying is that the Tennessee case tightened the standards and said it was no longer okay?
Yes.
And what was the standard that they put in?
That there had to be a threat to life kind of thing, or the person was dangerous, was a threat, not the officer. He could be a threat to somebody else and was needed to be stopped.
Thank you.
And that was essentially, I know the Portland Police Bureau had that in effect, like I say, when I went to work for them back in January of 74, because they were concerned about that. Part of this bill requires the Attorney General's office to set up protocols and so on for this kind of, for police shootings. The Attorney General's office doesn't do any of those kind of investigations. It really doesn't know anything about those. Now, that's not to say they couldn't set up protocols, but I talked with Attorney General Myers about this, and we need to be careful when we set up, when we put into law that they're going to do that. We need to say how they're going to do that, I think, so that it's done right. We need to have people involved from all sides to sit down and see to it
Jeff,
that the protocols are set.
if the Attorney General's not competent in this, who is?
Well, there's other people who investigate the things, the district attorney's offices who are involved in these kind of things.
How many district attorneys do we have in the state of Oregon?
36.
So all 36 of those individuals are more competent than the Attorney General?
I don't know that. They might be.
I would suggest that you're in error.
Okay.
But continue.
Well, the Attorney General's office doesn't have any experience investigating police shootings that I know of. And
are you familiar with the Attorney General's office and the fact that they have post-conviction murder investigations for homicide trials and that they employ former Portland police detectives?
I don't know who
they do that.
Are.
They do. So notwithstanding Mr. Meyer's comments.
Okay. But you asked who else should do that. I think the people like the police association groups should have some input into helping set up those protocols. I think that would make sense. And there's also different work needs in these investigations. What may work in Prineville may not work in Portland. So just those, we don't want too broad of a bill. There's a cost to this, which we just need to take into consideration, be aware of. I've heard this morning somebody say that the fiscal is over $1 million. We have to be sure the bill adequately considers the impact of Gary versus New Jersey, which gives public employee immunity if they're compelled to give testimony. And the bill has serious impacts on the grand jury process, eliminating the secrecy of one form of grand jury investigation sets a troublesome precedent that could change the willingness of witnesses and grand jurors to participate in the process. I think it's a good idea, the opening of the door. It's a fairly narrow opening of the door so that the grand juries can, so the public can see what happens in a grand jury involving a police shooting. I've talked with the district attorney from Multnomah County, and we've discussed that a bit, and he seems to think that will work, and he's pretty much convinced me that that could work. And that, I'll conclude with that.
All right. Any questions for St. Parker?
Just one. Representative Barker, could you please tell me what Gary versus New Jersey, what that case is?
If you order a police officer to talk, they're immune from prosecution on that. They have immunity.
Okay.
So if you compel somebody, subpoena them into a grand jury, made them answer the question, they could come in and say, I murdered somebody because I felt like it, and they would not be, you would not be able to prosecute them.
Is that an Oregon case or a U.S.
No.
Supreme Court case?
Supreme Court. Gary versus New Jersey.
U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
All right. Representative, I think that your comments are appropriate. The chair's intent to vet these issues fairly.
I'm sorry.
I said it's the chair's intent to vet these issues fairly thoroughly.
Good.
And I don't disagree with you that the other individuals affected by the bill should be participants in development of protocols, but I do disagree with the comments regarding the Attorney General and the Attorney General's competency with respect to these issues. And the objective of the amendment is to make these individuals competent, to raise a higher level of understanding and a higher level of scrutiny to these situations that are not just housed within one police agency or within one district attorney's office. The idea is to lift the veil of secrecy, at least the perception that there's a secrecy.
And I understand, Mr. Chair, that that's where you're going with that, and I applaud that. I just was, on paper, it looked like just the Attorney General's office, and that's all I'm saying is we need to have more people assist in getting that protocol set up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think at this point, and I probably should have done this before, counsel, would you do me a favor and go over the dash one amendment, so I think it's A5 amendment, is that what it is?
I will, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and members of the committee. I prepared a staff measure summary that, in bold, I went over the A5 amendments, and rather than go through them section by section, I wanted to go through them kind of, in a logical manner. Section 7 of the A5 amendments are on page 2. This is the section that provides the legislative findings regarding grand juries. And as Representative Barker pointed out, this points to the issues we have here with the historical secrecy of grand jurors and then the authorization by law of officers using deadly force and then the issues that require public scrutiny in this that I think, as it's put on page 3, that uniquely justify limited intrusions into the historic secrecy accorded grand jury proceedings. So that's the I would say that is kind of the starting point. Then from that point, I would direct you to section 10 of the amendments, which deal with investigations of the use of deadly force that caused death or serious physical injury. And section 10 provides that investigations of such a use of deadly force shall be directed by the district attorney of the county in which they occurred, and the attorney general shall be notified when that occurs. Also, section 10 points out that or directs that an agency other than the officer's employer must be involved in the investigation, and then that the district attorney that is directing the investigation may request the attorney general to lead the investigation if he wishes to. Then the AG, the Attorney General, is to review the final reports in any of these investigations, and then to establish protocols on how to conduct these investigations, and that should be completed by July 1, 2004. So that's the Section 10 that deals with investigations. Once the investigation is completed, I would then direct you to the portion of the bill that deals with grand juries. And that is Section 9 of the amendments, which state that in these situations, I will first direct you to Section 5, page 1 of this amendment. This amends ORS 132.330. Under current law, as you'll see in pages lines 6 and 7, for a district attorney to present a case to a grand jury, the district attorney must have good reason to believe that a crime has been committed which is triable within the county. Because of the nature of these issues and because we want a public investigation and public review, in these cases, a district attorney may present an investigation and does not have to have that requirement that there's that he or she makes that determination that there's good cause to believe a crime is committed. In Section 9, then, what we have is let me back up for a second. If the investigation results in death, we would then turn to the portion about the grand jury and recording of the grand jury. And that is in Section 9. In those situations, if a district attorney does present a case to the grand jury, the questioning of and the testimony of the witnesses must be recorded by a certified shorthand reporter.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
What is the current law on recording grand jury proceedings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, in Oregon, there is no recording or reporter of a grand jury. The grand jurors take notes, and those are kept confidential, and then ultimately are destroyed, usually.
So this would be the only example, and it's because of the special circumstances, where they would record grand jury proceedings.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that is correct, and in this bill, we wanted to make it clear that it would be actually having a reporter there, so we don't have any of the problems with a garbled record, which I'm sure you've, as an attorney, had to deal with.
Okay. Thank you.
Federal grand jury proceedings are always reported by a court reporter.
That's correct. And Mr. Chairman, I would point out that as far as the way that this is reported, the reporter is to keep the name of the grand jurors confidential. That was placed into the amendment so that the grand jurors would feel free to ask questions. That's on page 3, line 15 and 16. And then in Section 16 of the bill, which is at the last page, also regarding the grand jurors, it mandates that there shall be no contact with the grand jurors. The next portion of the bill I wanted to bring to your attention is once this report is made, then disclosure of that report and the transcript. That's the next step, and that's found in Section 9, Subsection 3, which states that in those situations where no criminal charges are returned or a not true bill is returned, the reporter then makes a transcript of and then hands it over to the court. The court then gives that transcript to the district attorney and the public safety officer who was investigated. And then we have a system for disclosure of that, which basically the system would be that the district attorney would notify all the witnesses who testified, and then the officer, the district attorney, and the witnesses would have an opportunity to ask the court and make a motion to the court to keep the record confidential. The standard for whether or not it should be kept confidential in all or a part of that transcript is found on page 4, lines 20 to 27 of the amendments. And I think you can see that the basic weighing the court would make would be the public interest in disclosure, which is the presumption. And then if these motions are filed, that could be rebutted basically by these factors that are listed on lines 20 to 27.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ringo.
What's the current law on confidentiality of grand jury proceedings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, currently they're confidential. The only ways, in my experience, and I'm sure there's others who have more experience with this, would be situations where a witness, say, refers to what they said in grand jury, and then they are brought out. But currently, the notes are kept confidential.
I mean, is there any prohibition against people disclosing what was said during the grand jury proceeding?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Ringo, I think the disclosure issues are during the impaneling of that grand jury. They're not to speak about it. Then when, under current law, once the grand jury is done, then they could be approached as they are approached and then speak about it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, yes, it's interesting that we're talking about this. I reported for federal grand jury for 3 years, and after I stopped reporting about a year later, they became more strict about their requirements for the court reporters who were reporting, and that's not because they had a problem, but they decided that they wanted strict confidentiality. So their court reporter, actually to report for federal grand jury, I had to get a background check. Then they require all the notes to be stored in a vault, and there are other requirements that the court reporter meet, and I believe some of those should be transferable here, and I would be willing to discuss with the federal court in Eugene what the requirements are for their court reporters, because I think that's really important that we maintain it. If the court's going to require that it be confidential, then the court reporter's notes need to be secured, and we need to have that taken care of. So I will make those calls and get more information about that.
Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if it would be possible during the course of hearing on this bill, I would like to know a little more about the history of the development of the secrecy and confidentiality of the grand jury.
Mm-hmm. I think that's appropriate.
And the reason I think that, I mean, I'm under the strong impression that grand jury proceedings are not subject to the rules of evidence. The grand jury hears a great deal of hearsay, which is possibly uncorroborated. Information is to be sifted by the grand jury in their investigation. It is not an investigation conducted by the district attorney. The DA is not in charge of the grand jury. He's there to assist only. The investigation is actually conducted by the jurors, and they have great latitude in what they hear before making the decision about returning a true bill or not indicting. And a lot of that information is could be extremely damaging to individuals, private citizens, and innocent parties. So, I mean, I think those are the positions in which the confidentiality of the grand jury's base, and I'd like to hear that put in some sort of context here.
All right. I think that's appropriate. We should have some discussion about that, because I think some of the issues that you raised are not accurate, particularly with respect to rules of evidence being applied, et cetera, but we'll get some background on that. All right.
Mr. Chairman, just to conclude, I wanted to point out also that if a public safety officer does testify, there would basically be a civil immunity for the testimony he gives would not be admissible evidence in a civil proceeding. This is an encouragement for the officer to be sworn in and questioned by the grand jury. However, if it is later shown that the officer makes inconsistent statements, those prior statements made in the grand jury could be used to impeach. This is a basic hearsay rule or a rule of evidence that is used in impeaching witnesses. I would point out that this does not. I think there'll be speakers that will deal in some detail with the immunities issues. So I'm just going to leave those and stick to the bill itself and move. So we've gone from the investigation to how the grand jury is conducted to disclosure, and then lastly the training portion of the amendments, which I'll go over. First of all, as far as the investigations, as I mentioned, the Attorney General is to establish protocols on how those are to be conducted. And as far as training, the board of the DPSST is to train on investigations, how they should to be conducted based upon those protocols. And then also the DPSST is to train on the on what is termed as critical incident use of force. In layman's, you know, what I would call that is putting officers in their training in situations where they have to make decisions about whether to use deadly force. This would be mandated to be part of the training. And then lastly, the legislature is to review these training protocols.
All right, Senator Ringo.
Craig, I'm curious about the Attorney General's review of the District Attorney's report. It doesn't say what the AG does with that review. Is there?
I think number one, it's intended to be not the District Attorney's report. It is the complete investigative file. By all of those officers and individuals that participated in the investigation. And this particular product you have in front of you is not perfect, by the way. Some of these issues will have to be vetted out. But the question has come up, although it's not in the amendment, what does the Attorney General do? And the idea is that they would, if the reports are deficient in some way or inconsistent with the protocols that have been developed, that they might send a letter to the agency requesting additional follow-up or requesting additional information be provided or an acknowledgement that the protocols were not followed in certain circumstances, et cetera. So.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a comment, to me that seems appropriate. If you're going to give them the duty to review, then it is appropriate to say what they'll do with the review, and if it means that they find the investigation wasn't appropriate or it wasn't in accordance with protocols, then they can, like you said, write a letter, somehow comment on that.
And just, I think for the committee to understand, this particular amendment started out much, 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 much stronger
I see.
Than what you see
okay.
in front of you. And I met with, and I think Senator Gordley and Senator Carter, and I met with various parties, including the Attorney General's Office, and the District Attorneys, the Sheriff's Association, and others who had various comments, and this is the end result of what most of those comments have been so far. So,
thank you.
That's a little bit of help. The other thing I want to have counsel talk about just for a minute is there's been in the public some discussion about public inquest and why not use the public inquest process that exists. And I think the reasons why it's problematic ought to be at least identified for the committee so that we understand why that process is problematic.
Mr. Chairman, senators, members of the committee, Chapter 146. Of the Oregon statutes have a portion on investigation of deaths in a public inquest, and some of the issues I think are the same as in a grand jury. They deal with immunities, and of course, just when we say immunities, the issues broadly are when you have someone testify, you subpoena them into court, And then if you that's a compelling of the testimony. When you're compelling testimony like that, immunity is granted. And I should say it becomes technical whether or not then if you say you had a situation where someone came in and then inculpated themselves with their testimony with what is known as transactional immunity, which we have argued wings in this state, and again, this is a complex issue that I'm going to try to gloss over. The danger is you could immunize that person in total from any prosecution for what they just admitted to. And so it's a very difficult thing to apply without having that risk. And so in my experience, what normally occurs in any case of a grand jury, for example, is you have the person subpoenaed to the grand jury, and then before you have them testify, you generally have a what I would do in my experience would say, I am not going to compel you to testify. If you want to testify, you're welcome to. That way, it's my belief that you're not then compelling. But I just want to gloss that issue because that is an issue for public inquest or a grand jury. The public inquest, I guess one of the issues is what really that system, what findings would be made by a public inquest. Those are usually done in situations where there's a dead or missing person, and the findings are who the deceased person was, when and where the deceased person came to death, the cause of death, and the manner of death. I think one of the reasons that it would be difficult to apply, and I'm sure there's some disagreement on this, would be that many of the questions that I believe we're here to deal with in front of a grand jury would not really be answered in that type of forum. And so rather than try to place it into that, we tried to set up a forum in the grand jury where there is a public review of this by citizens that they can do. And that's one of the reasons why I'll lead you that back to Section 5 of the amendments that says the DA doesn't need to say, I believe there's a crime that took place and I'm seeking a criminal charge or that's I have a good reason to believe that a crime was committed. We've tried to set up a situation where this is the forum for public review of these uses of deadly force.
All right. Other questions before we start with
witnesses? Yeah, just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for background. Just to lay some background for me, how many cases per year do we have of deadly physical force by a public safety officer that results in the death of someone statewide? Do we have those kind of figures?
The only statistics I have, and I'll get this or make it available, is in the last 5 years. In Oregon, I don't have a total compilation. Portland had 38 shootings or deaths. Bend had one. Central Point had one. Eugene had four.
Is it any shootings?
Well, they're officer-involved shootings within the last 5 years, and I'd have to talk to Mr. Campbell, who provided the information, and I'm not sure if these resulted in death. I've seen that they had.
So. Mr. Chairman, I don't believe... I don't believe that's correct. They all resulted in death. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the things when we began crafting this, we realized that there's not a central area that keeps record of deaths and injuries resulting from use of deadly force. And on page 7, lines 1 through 3 of the amendment, the Attorney General would maintain those records so we would have a better ability. The records that the Chairman is referring to were just compiled kind of ad hoc through the different agencies throughout the state.
Well, and I appreciate that because I think it's important to know, is this an epidemic across the state or is it just something that occasionally happens? And if it does happen more in one place than another, then I think it's appropriate to review procedures.
Well, and I think we did ask for some information, and maybe we'll vet that out a little bit later. There is some data and information provided on officer-involved or public safety officer-involved incidents like this in other regions, and I'll provide that for the committee.
Okay.
Fatal shootings by the police, 1990 to 2000, and the data speaks for itself, and you can ask questions based on that. Portland, I won't speak to whether or not Portland has a specific variance from other agencies. I think the data is a little bit confusing at this point. Probably better to speak to an expert.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's great. I'd like to get a little background on that, just know what kind of a problem we have here in Oregon.
All right. Thank you. We're going to move on now. Senators Ava Gordley and Senator Carter, do you want to come up and speak now and redeem your time? Once you get on,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We've asked our DA to come up with us.
All right, great.
If you don't mind.
I think I've been prevailed upon to go first. I'm Mike Schrunk, the district attorney of Multnomah County. Just brief background, I've been the elected district attorney for 20 plus years. I defended and prosecuted homicide cases. I'm here, and let me give you copies. A written testimony in support of this bill and the amendments to it. And I think probably I've heard your questions, and I appreciate the questions, and I'll try and answer afterwards for you or at a later time if you want something in writing. Grand juries have existed for centuries, and literally they started out to prevent abuse of power by the king. And this is, we've evolved into a situation where no one can be charged with a felony, in the state of Oregon certainly, but for an indictment by a grand jury or a preliminary hearing. And there's virtually no preliminary hearings. There are good reasons for grand juries, and there are good reasons for the secrecy of grand juries. Protection of witnesses, protection of victims of crime, protection of grand jurors, citizens who become involved and will step forward and say we want this case indicted, and also to protect those innocent that have been wrongfully accused of a crime. These are good reasons for secrecy in the grand jury. But I think the grand jury system has evolved, and I'm convinced by practical experience that in special circumstances, and the amendments to House Bill 3426 presents these special circumstances, that the grand jury veil of secrecy ought to be lifted in certain circumstances. And these are adequately sent out. Police do use deadly physical force. This is unfortunate. It's a tragedy anytime that happens. But in fact, it does happen. The public always questions. Now imagine, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, if you closed this door, if you locked this door, and you had all of us testify in secret about something very near and dear to the public, what would the perception be on the outside? Not imputing any bad intentions by any of you or by any of the witnesses, but the press wouldn't be in, the public wouldn't be in, and they would be told thumbs up, thumbs down. True bill, no true bill, nothing. What would people presume? And this is one of the veils that we need to list. People would presume the worst. And I think in a limited circumstance, this removes that veil of secrecy and provides public light on what goes on with a citizen grand jury, citizen witnesses, police witnesses, about something that is very, very important in the community. And I think, let me just briefly tell you, the recordation. Senator Walker, as you pointed out, you've worked as a reporter. Federal grand juries record all the time. It's not new. There's a fiscal cost to it, but it is not great because it is narrowed here. If we limit it to deadly physical force that causes death and then subsequent public disclosure, I don't believe there would be harm to the good reasons for a closed grand jury session. It would provide, also your amendment provides for outside agencies. Many of the complaints about investigations is that an agency cannot investigate itself. You've made provisions in here to involve other agencies. We've done this for a long time. We've used, in the recent Kendra James tragedy, we've used a Gresham policeman. We used a Multnomah County sheriff policeman involved with the Portland Police Bureau investigative teams. This is common sense. It's a check and it's a balance. It's a good one. The authority to review by the Attorney General. Very important. It's centralized. As you ask questions, Senator Burdick, how many? Is there any central number? There is no central repository that we have that we can come up and tell you. I can tell you that we've run statistics, and roughly, I think, there have been 55 in the last 10 years in Portland with approximately 17 fatalities. I don't know if that's accurate. I can't tell you what happened in Deschutes County. Maybe Mr. Dugan can, but we have no base. I do not view as an independently elected district attorney for Multnomah County, supposedly reflective of the constituency there, any threat by involving the Attorney General. I think that's good. There are several technical changes, and I've listed those for you, that I would recommend, although they are not crucial. They're not crucial to my support. In Section 9, when you say parties that may file a motion to limit disclosure, I would add a public safety agency, not only individuals, but perhaps a police agency or some other port authority that has a public safety component may want to file that. Section 10, I would say, if you're worried about the fiscal cost of this, limit it to the use of deadly force that results in a death. Section 16, I would say that you should allow persons who wish to contact the jury, a grand jury, to petition the court, but add the provision making the names and addresses of such grand jurors exempt from disclosure. I think those are important. And this is a difficult concept. It's born, we're here, partially because it should have been done long ago and partially because of a tragedy in the metropolitan area. There will be other tragedies. I'd like not to have to be down here again talking about what we should do to fix and to shed public light on it. I want to thank you, the chair, the members of the legislature, the members of the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, the DA's Association, and a number of other citizens for the input they've had. I've looked at numerous drafts of this. Craig Prinz, your committee counsel, has worked diligently working with everyone. While all agencies or all people that I've mentioned are not wholeheartedly supporting this, I think their input has been very valuable. It has made what started out as a good idea and a good concept an even better concept. It's going to serve the citizens of Oregon well. I would urge you to move forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ringo.
Thanks very much. Is it your prerogative as district attorney to initiate the grand jury?
That is correct.
And what's the standard that you use?
Well, grand juries currently are impaneled by the court, and they be convened to investigate any crime within a jurisdiction. In your jurisdiction, Bob Herman could convene a grand jury, or a citizen could petition your presiding judge to convene a grand jury and investigate alleged crimes within that jurisdiction.
But I guess, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I guess I'm trying to understand what standard you use to decide whether to initiate a grand jury, whether there's some likelihood that there was a criminal act committed, whether it was, I mean, there has to be some standard you follow.
Right now, a grand jury is required to, there's statutory language about how it can return an indictment. And it's initially, the initial, whether you convene a grand jury is like, is there probable cause? Is there a matter that needs to be investigated and sometimes develops probable cause? Then the standard for returning an indictment is if the evidence uncontradicted would support a conviction by a trial jury than they are told to indict. This is an exception, as you'll notice, and I think Craig Prinz outlined for you in Section 2. And this is not typically where you say we're seeking an indictment, but they may present an investigation. And this is a citizen group that would have oversight, and they would review an investigation conducted into law enforcement use of deadly physical force. Well, so this would be separate, Senator Ringel.
The statute is, any counsel just handed me, says the district attorney may submit an indictment to the grand jury in any case in which the district attorney has good reason to believe that a crime has been committed.
That's correct.
And that is the legal standard.
That is. And most district attorneys would say, is there probable cause to believe that a crime has been...
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair. Yes. So let's say that there was a police shooting and you believe that there was not good reason to believe that a crime had been committed. Then you would not request a grand jury.
That would be optional in Section 2 of this amendment. The district attorney may present an investigation. There's a distinction between submit an indictment to the grand jury in Section 1, 132.330, and Section 2. In Section 2 specifically would apply to when deadly physical force would be used, and it uses the word may. It would be optional with the district attorney.
And you're looking at subsection 2 of Section 6?
Of Section 5.
I see. I guess the point that I'm trying to come to is that I would think that in all cases of police shootings, there needs to be some sort of public airing, public investigation. Even if there's not large suspicion that a crime had been committed, even if you think that a crime had not been committed, it still makes sense to me that witnesses would be interviewed and the public would be able to receive all facts. And you're telling me that could happen, and it would happen in the context of a grand jury.
That is correct. That's what this provides for. Senator Ringo, okay. I happen to agree with you. And when I became district attorney, I made a decision that law enforcement caused deaths and would be submitted to a citizen grand jury. And so we've done it in almost 100%. There are occasions where there's a bank robber or someone is shot in a shootout, and you just say, golly, that's too bad, and you go away.
I mean, there may be circumstances where the use of deadly force seems totally justified.
And that's why the word may is used in your draft. And I think that's... But I happen to agree with you. What these amendments do is... If the grand jury is the vehicle used, the grand jury protocols, the grand jury statutes provide for secrecy. This lifts the veil of secrecy. It opens the door, and it allows for a transcript to be reviewed by the public or by parties that are interested. And that's in a very narrow special circumstance. I wholeheartedly agree with you. There needs to be some hearing. There needs to be some letting the community know what their law enforcement are doing and in the manner they're acting.
Thank you. I mean, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I know that you have spent many hours on this issue, and I'm coming to it brand new, but just an initial impression that I have is that there ought to be an investigation and a public investigation whenever deadly force is used, and I'm not sure why it has to be in the grand jury context. I mean, grand juries obviously conjure up images of prosecution and crimes committed, and maybe that's appropriate, maybe it's not appropriate, but I think every instance of deadly force ought to have a public investigation.
I think this amendment, as originally written, was very broad, as I said earlier, and did encompass that in all circumstances, death, serious physical injury, you would have a grand jury presentation, and subsequently that reveal. Like the district attorneys who spoke in the group felt that they needed to have some discretion because their practices do not necessarily mirror the practices of Mr. Shrunken in Multnomah County. And to a large degree, much of the submission or decision by the district attorney would be a political decision, in some senses, by the community that would be responding to a circumstance. And I think Bend had a shooting a number of years back that was largely profiled in papers around the state that I'm not sure what their process was, but whether they went to a grand jury or not, was something like that, where it's a high-profile case. I think the district attorney would probably be well served to use this process. But the attempt here is to try to apply or allow some latitude for district attorneys who may not be using the similar practices that Multnomah County currently does. That's the justification. And then also embedded in this is the idea that, and hopefully this is it's why we have attorney general protocols being developed and why we have the investigations being submitted to the attorney general in both the cases of the resultant death of an individual and or serious physical injury of a person would be submitted to the attorney general. The idea there is that these cases would, in fact, receive an investigation. Not that they don't now, but I don't think there's anything statutorily that directs that there be a complete and thorough investigation of these kind of cases. And I think to some degree there's a broad amount of discretion by agencies or district attorneys with respect to the depth of the investigation. It's my opinion that these investigations should be complete, and they should be done to the utmost level of professionalism. And then I think in some instances there ought to be the public review issue that's necessary, I think, in these circumstances. So.
Thank you.
Other questions or issues? Senator Fordley or Senator Carter? Who was first?
I'll go.
All right.
Thank you. And good morning, Chair Menas and members of the committee. For the record, I am Abel Fordley. I represent Senate District 23, which includes Northeast and Southeast Portland. First of all, Chair Menas, I would like to say to you, thank you. Thank you 1,000 times for your leadership and for stepping up to take on this issue in this legislative session. And I would like to also express thanks to our district attorney, Michael Shrunk, for his leadership, to the other district attorneys and the attorney general, to Representative Barker, to all of those who have had anything to do with addressing this important piece of public policy and getting us to this place today. And I also want to acknowledge the efforts of your committee counsel, Craig Krenz. His work on this bill has just been absolutely outstanding. I am here to express strong support for House Bill 3426 and to convey the support of Portland Police Chief Mark Croker, whom I had the opportunity to speak with last evening at the community forum. I believe you're all aware that there was a community forum in Portland last night focused on a recent shooting that resulted in the tragic loss of life. 450 people came out to express their concerns about police use of deadly force and about the administration of justice in our community. There must be public access points to the grand jury process when incidents that result in death due to the use of deadly force occur. The overwhelming public interest is for transparency in the process, and this bill provides an opportunity to make needed improvements in the administration of justice. That's what this is about, how justice is administered. These improvements specify when peace officers and corrections officers may use deadly force, and if the use of deadly force results in death, the death of a person, it sets forth a structure and a process that allows for public scrutiny through a review of the grand jury record. This bill is absolutely necessary, and though it comes with a fiscal impact, Mr. Chair and committee members, we must not let that prohibit us from moving the policy forward. Let me also say, on reflection of last night's community forum, it is unhealthy in our democracy to have a significant segment of the community not trust or respect the police or the courts. And that's where we are today. We have a great deal of mistrust out there that we need to recognize and address. You only have to look at the front page of the Oregonian to get a sense of the magnitude of the issue and how it's being addressed in the Portland community. The people that I represent are watching, they are waiting, they are watching us, they're waiting for a signal that says they have been heard. They want this, they want these improvements in the administration of justice. There is another related critical issue, Mr. Chair, that I would like to also address while I have the microphone. As legislators, we need to pay more attention to the issue of how our law enforcement personnel are trained. We have become aware in the last few weeks through information from Diane Middle, Oregon's Basic Training Academy director, that our police recruits attending the state academy do not receive adequate training in patrol procedures. They do not receive adequate training in tactical communications and diffusing hostility. They do not receive adequate training in cultural awareness and diversity. They do not receive adequate training in handling mentally ill people. They do not receive adequate training in firearms. They do not receive adequate training in emergency vehicle operations and legal issues. There is no training at the Basic Academy on the use of less lethal weapons. There is no training at the Basic Academy on the Response to Terrorist Acts. There is no training at the Academy on gang recognition. There is no training at the Academy on recognition of explosive devices and traffic control techniques. I hope that we are all appalled that this is the status of the training that we provide to our law enforcement personnel. The substandard training places our law enforcement people in jeopardy, places their lives in jeopardy, and places, as we know now, tragically, the lives of our citizens in jeopardy. This is a situation that must be corrected, and I would hope that we would assign addressing the training issues and the training issues or lack thereof at the training academy, assign this issue a much greater urgency than has been the case to date.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Senator Gordley, that's a very good point that you make, and I want to get it on the record like I've seen it on the record every time I have been in the legislature for the last 6 years, last three sessions, that we only train our officers for a certain period of weeks, and I'm going to let you share that with the committee here because I know the answer. But tell us, Senator Gordley, how little we train our officers, what we're supposed to train our officers at, and what the national standard is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, the state's 10-week 400-hour basic police academy is less than half the national 22-week average for entry-level training and less demanding than the 1,100 training hours required to become a licensed Oregon barber.
Could you repeat that last figure, please, Senator, about the barber?
In order to become a licensed Oregon barber, a person would receive 1,100 training hours as compared to the 400-hour basic police academy now offered in Oregon.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Byrd.
Our statistics show that the biggest problem we have is in Portland. And the Portland Police Bureau does not train their officers through DPSST. They have their own training program. Have you looked at that and analyzed that as well in terms of its adequacy?
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, I'm going to correct your statement, and I'm going to rely on Senator Minnis as well to help me with this. But I believe that the Portland Police candidates also go through the DPSST Academy in addition to the regional program.
I think Senator Gurley, and I think Mark Landauer from the City of Portland may be able to correct this, but I think there's a combination. They have been doing their own academies in the past. 2001 legislative session through legislation that I sponsored forces the City of Portland and other agencies to participate in the state's basic academy, and that's predicated upon the construction of the larger training facility that we're investing in. But there is, I think, currently the allowance under statute that they can continue up until, I think there's a date in statute now, 2004, and there's an exemption that is in this process that the Senate body killed on the floor the other day that had an exemption setting it out to 2007 to allow for the construction of the project. They killed it for another reason, but the bill's actually in our possession. And so I think it's kind of a hybrid. I think we've got officers. I'm looking, Mark. Do we have officers going through the basic academy now, or they do go through basic academy?
We have training programs. All right.
Three basic training programs in the City of Portland, but now going through the state's academy system. That was Mark Landauer, the City of Portland, for the record. All right. And we're passing out, by the way, a letter from Ms. Middle to Senator Gordley regarding some of the issues that we just spoke to. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my testimony, and I appreciate very much the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. Senator Carter.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We've had an excellent walkthrough from the district attorney in terms of House Bill 3426-A and certainly Senator Gordley giving comments in terms of the training and other issues. I just want to enlighten you a little bit on the historical and social comments in terms of this amendment today and its importance, and remind us that when this great commonwealth was founded, only certain persons could settle. Only gender of one could vote, could serve on the grand jury, could participate in the writing and formulation of statutes and the constitution of this state. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, only one race, one gender could even serve on a jury. In 1987, I sponsored a bill that dealt with the jury pool, and you'd be totally amazed at all of the opposition in terms of looking at the jury pool that we had. And later on, some years later, that bill also was taken out of statute to tell you how, yes, we've come a long ways, but yet we've also retreated in many ways. And so I think when we look at this system, only a certain few express and fully participate in our system. And as you heard of the history of the grand jury system from our Attorney General, he expressed that kind of issue in terms of the quietness, or let me say the closeness of the grand jury in this country. So I can say truly that we've crossed many bridges and we've traveled many roads together as a society, but we have a very different society today. And within the framework of this great society we have today, we have a rule of law, Mr. Chairman. And so the proposed amendments understand this progression, colleagues, And that with time, with understanding and greater comprehension, change can come and does need to occur. And, Mr. Chairman, may I say to you that in this environment that we have today, many of you are concerned about the cost that is associated with this, but I have to say back to you, talk to us about the cost of the social impact of the loss of life in many of our communities and the potential happenings that could come as a result of people's mistrust and distrust in the system, and you do the math. The proposed amendments put light on the rule of law and will inspire, I think, greater confidence in society. We are at another crossroads in an opening society, and one that places faith and continues to place greater and greater faith in the integrity of the citizenry and the citizenry's understanding and participation in comprehension of this great process. So I recommend and commend to the chair and to this committee, and later I shall to the Legislative Assembly and to the Governor, that we adopt these forward-looking, innovative amendments that I personally thank the chair for his hard work with my office, with Senator Gordley, and I would like to thank Senator Abel Gordley and counsel to the committee, Mr. Craig Penns, for certainly what is a creative, innovative Oregon solution, resolution, and first step in creating greater confidence, faith, and belief in greater integrity in the judicial and policing system. I want to thank my friend Mike Dugan and other district attorneys and sheriff departments and others who've worked so very hard, even sometimes disagreeing, but understanding the importance of moving forward. And let me say to you, you are removing, or you can remove, a stigma, a cloak of darkness to a system in the memory of one people that has been a source of power to oppression. The truth, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, frees us all, and in these amendments is all of our freedom. So I truly thank you for this work and for this deliberation this morning, and I look forward to a positive passing out of this measure, and I'm hoping that with all due diligence and with the grace of God that guides all of us, that your hearts and your consciousness will understand the importance of this bill today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator. Shrunk, before you go, I want to ask, even though Senator Farrell is not present for the record, if you would discuss the issues of hearsay evidence in grand juries or grand jury questioning of witnesses and your role as a district attorney. And I think we covered some of that earlier, but particularly with respect to hearsay information or rules of evidence and such.
The rules of evidence, with certain exceptions that have been granted by the legislature, apply for only evidence that would be relevant and admissible at trial to be presented to the grand jury. You also have before you in the legislature one aspect, and I think I've corresponded with a number of you about that, to allow an officer, if there's no objection, to testify as to someone else's report, the colleague's report. But by and large, only admissible evidence is permitted. One of the questions, and again, and both Senator Carter and Senator Gordley alluded to it, is if there's no record, the grand jury doesn't do anything, there's always the suspicion that non-relevant, non-pertinent, in fact, improper evidence was permitted before that citizen grand jury, and perhaps that they were misled by a district attorney. And that's why I think I welcome this bill and these amendments, because it does remove that cloak in a certain narrow area. And I think we can only benefit. I don't think district attorneys do bad things. I don't think police do bad things, although bad things happen sometimes. And I think this further will create faith with the community. The bad things do not happen, and a transcript, and people can see chapter and verse. So this goes a long ways towards the type of evidence that would be permitted.
Senator Burdick.
Would there be any bar besides the fiscal one of going straight to a federal system where everything is recorded?
Quite frankly, I personally have favored this. I can't speak for other district attorneys. They will have differing opinions. There is a tremendous fiscal cost, and I suspect Senator Walker can talk about some of that. There is increased judicial cost, because once the transcript is created, then my colleagues, the men and women lawyers, will quibble over what is permissible. There will be the cost of doing the transcript, and then added judicial time as to when it is usable or not. So I think it would be, if Senator Burdick, if you look at grand jury reform movements around the country for the past several decades, and you look at what other states have done, that is happening, the complete recordation. Now, as I suspect Senator Ringo knows, it is optional, and you can do it on a motion of the court. And there's some case law that tells us if you record one witness, you record them all. And then the rules of discovery come in as to when they're transmitted. But it's a very imprecise system because it's left, whether you do it with a cassette recorder, and then we have the Nixonian 18 minutes of silence or nothing. And that's one of the things Craig Prinz talked about. One of the reasons is let's have a real live, certified, competent court reporter, not someone just voluntarily working a tape machine. In there.
Okay. Senator Walker.
Thank you. It's a great segue. Thank you, Mr. Shrunk, because court reporters do provide a valuable service. And unfortunately, because of the cuts to the courts, that's one of the first areas that most jurisdictions have cut. Lane County is one of the few court systems that still employs live court reporters, and I think they're even in danger now. And the court reporters are wanting to propose that we at least have live court reporters in capital cases, because those are always appealed. And your reference to the Nixonian 18 minutes is very interesting, because just this session, I was transcribing a hearing in my Business and Labor Committee on an issue that's very important to me, and I'm transcribing it from the tape, and all of a sudden the tape goes blank and we go into the next witness. And I'm like, am I not getting this right? Did I not put the tape in correctly? So when I met with committee staff, it turned out that when some of the out-of-town witnesses turned the lights down so that we could view a video, it turned the audio off on the tape. And so now we are forever without about 15 minutes of testimony that I felt was critical to the issue at hand. So there are serious problems with that. And the other issue that you talked about what goes on in grand jury proceedings and people have concerns about what's being said, I've been in those proceedings. Those grand jurors ask a lot of questions. It depends a little bit on the panel. Some panels were more inquisitive than others, but they ask a ton of questions because they're just ordinary citizens who don't know the law, and you don't know on the outside what the attorney is giving them, what the district attorney or the attorney for the federal government, the assistant attorney, are giving them, what kind of information they're giving them in response to their questions. And it's based on that they make their decision to indict or not indict. And you're right, that's really critical for the public to know. And in the federal system, I never transcribed everything, but more often than not, when someone had an indictment returned against them and they went to trial, you got a request for a transcript. So it does increase the cost, by and large, because pretty soon people do want to see what was said in that grand jury. It's really important to know. But there's also a reason there's a veil of secrecy. There's a reason that you don't want to divulge the identity of the witnesses who come in to testify. They're scared. I've seen them. I've seen them be very scared to testify, but they know that it's secret. So you need to preserve that, and I think that these amendments address that issue. But I understand the concern.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I think that's exactly what the chair and Craig Prinz and all those who've had input into the numerous drafts, they've tried to save the best and yet lift that veil and make sure there's the maximum protections for all citizens. So.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for this? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask the committee, since we've got a long list of people, if your schedules can allow coming back at 1 o'clock.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think
it's
what I am.
You're
available. I had an engagement, but...
1:30?
Well, I had an engagement for the afternoon, but I could, in the interest of justice, change that.
All right, we'll see if we can get how far we can get through this, but I just want to pose the question to the committee. We're going to start with Mitch Morrow from the Department of Corrections.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Morrow, Assistant Director for the Institution Division for the Department of Corrections. I'm here in support of House Bill 3426. What this bill does is it clarifies for the department the use of deadly force within our institutions and in community situations. It also authorizes the department to use lethal force to prevent escapes of inmates from our secure perimeters, from the grounds of these institutions, during the custody and transport of inmates outside of DOC facilities, to maintain or restore order or discipline in our institutions in the event of a riot or disturbance, and finally, in situations that threaten the life or safety of department employees, inmates, or other persons. And it's, I know that's very brief, but that's what this particular bill does for the Department of Corrections, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, any questions for Mr. Morrow?
This started out as a police issue, and then all of a sudden, the Department of Corrections pops in with, a section relating to your policies. What are your policies now? What was the problem that was being addressed here?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding is the statutes that were in place in regards to the use of deadly force only really dealt with escapes from our institutions, our secure perimeter institutions. And so we saw the need to bring all the statutes that relate to the use of deadly force into one place, and this bill provided us the opportunity to do that.
Senator Walker, you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask the similar question that I thought we already have a statute that governs deadly force, and the testimony is only if someone is escaping from the institution?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's my understanding. That's all that we really had in place that covered the use of deadly force by DOC staff.
Okay. Well, I think we'll probably get some testimony from the criminal defense lawyers. It talks about this a little bit more. So thank you, Mr. Morrow.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Brett Berry, District Attorney's Association. All right. And Mr. Dugan, are you going to come up at the same time? Or?
I can.
Your Honor.
You put it on my mail, I guess.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Brad Berry. I'm Yamhill County District Attorney, and I am Vice President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, as well as I am the Chair for the Legislative Committee for the Association. And I'm here in part to talk on behalf of the Association and for myself personally on the amendments to this bill. I would like to begin by sharing some accolades that have already been given to both Senator Minnis and to Mr. Prinz. This bill, when Senator Minnis first called us to a meeting and handed it out, had many things that I would say caused me personally some pretty big concern, as well as other DAs in the state. And Senator Minnis has been more than willing to listen to our comments, incorporate those, and Craig can probably tell you that he's tied up, or I have tied up, more of his email box than anyone I can think of over the last couple of weeks in attempting to make this the best bill that it can be. with that, on behalf of the association, we reviewed this hours and hours of discussion about this particular bill, and I'll discuss some of those concerns in a moment. But ultimately, the association opted to take no position on the bill. And that, in great part, is due to kind of a large discrepancy throughout the state on the recordation of grand jury proceedings. This issue has come up before, and as Mr. Shrunk spoke about, we genuinely, in a principled belief, feel that grand juries are confidential for good reasons. They protect not only witnesses who fear reprisal on coming forward. Although I should point out there was a comment about not knowing who witnesses are before the grand jury, and they are listed actually on an indictment. But what exactly they say at grand jury has been confidential, and that is to encourage them to come forth. In this day and age, it is not uncommon that grand juries are reviewing cases which involve sex offenses, and I can tell you, having handled those cases personally, that we have some very young witnesses come before a grand jury and talk about some very difficult and intimate things that have occurred to them, and all too often they've been victimized by those people who they have dearly loved in the past. That too is a reason why the confidentiality of grand juries should be maintained. And last, certainly not least, the confidentiality of grand jury proceedings in large part protect those who are accused of offenses and who are not indicted. I can assure you that if a principal in a grade school in one of your communities is accused of sexual abuse, and then a grand jury on reviewing that case finds a not true bill, finds that there is insufficient evidence to indict, many in the community will recall the accusation and not recall that the not true bill was issued by a grand jury. And that, too, is a reason why confidentiality of grand jury proceedings should be maintained. Having said that, though, I recognize that this bill, as it currently is put out and before you, calls for a limited intrusion and recordation on cases involving death and the use of deadly force by police officers. And I have actually come from a position of opposition to one where I can carefully support this bill as it is. It is important, I believe, that the legislative findings within this bill acknowledge the purpose for confidentiality of grand jury proceedings and further acknowledge, as it is put forth before you, that in fact these are cases that are sensitive to our communities and that are different to our communities than are the regular cases, the many cases, the thousands of cases that go before our grand juries every year in this state. This bill, though, is not without some remaining concerns. I believe that Pete Shepard from the Attorney General's office will address some of those, and the Attorney General's office, as well as the DA's Association, have been active with one another to have kind of, you know, we see this issue and they see an issue, and we tried to have those issues all come forth, and I know that Mr. Shepard will be talking about those, but I would like to address some issues that we see remain in this bill. First is the cost to local agencies. You will note that as the bill is currently drafted, it requires that the public safety agency, whose officer is involved in the use of deadly force, is responsible for paying for the court reporter and the subsequent transcript which is produced from that. The difficulty with this bill is it comes, I think, in light of all the stuff that's gone on in Portland now, and we look at this in the light of large agencies such as the Portland Police Bureau. Their ability to give up $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for a several-day transcript is certainly different than in my community, where the city of Amity has a chief of police and one police officer would have absolutely no ability to produce a transcript and to pay for that transcript. What will occur, by the way the bill is currently set out, is that the district attorneys are responsible for acquiring the court reporter, and then ultimately we will have to pick up that expense. Not to speak for Mr. Shrunk, but I'm going to guess that his budget would be more capable of handling that kind of an expense than, in fact, mine would be. But let's talk about counties on the eastern part of the state where, in fact, there are one or two deputies, very small budgets, and they, too, could be crippled by this mandate.
Madam Chair? So what are you suggesting in that regard?
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair, and Senator Ringo, grand juries are the function of the court. and it is our suggestion that ultimately the court would be responsible for that. I think you'll find that Mr. Shepard will propose that ultimately the district attorneys would be responsible for paying for the expense, but a bill and part of this bill would apply for where we would seek reimbursement from a particular fund with the state, which would estimate what those costs would be and would pay that back, I think, from the court budget.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Berry, this is not a situation that happens all the time, however. When you talk about it crippling the agency and your costs, we're talking about a situation that does not arise that often. So I can't imagine that this would cripple your budget, because it may not happen for several years. Isn't that true?
Chair Senator Walker, that is absolutely true, that it may not. But we don't know when it will occur. I'm looking at agencies in my county. Again, Yamhill County is kind of a medium-sized county. We have about 86,000 people in my county. Every law enforcement agency in my county is losing personnel currently because of this. And I can tell you that even the largest law enforcement agency outside of the Oregon State Police in my county would be hard-pressed to find a several thousand dollars to pay for a transcript. We have had a shooting in my county since I've been district attorney. I've been DA since December of 1996. I should know that date a lot better than that, but since 96, and we did have a shooting in my county. It did not result in death. In fact, it didn't result in serious physical injury. The person who was shot was out of the hospital overnight. However, if we had had to move forward on that, I'm not sure where those costs would have come from, and that's even out of my sheriff's office, who would have the largest budget in the county of law enforcement.
All right, thank you.
A few other concerns on this that I do think ought to be addressed. One has already been mentioned, and that is the undefined role of the Attorney General in this review process. And I believe it was Senator Ringo who brought up that particular issue, and I tend to agree. I think it needs to be defined in two areas. One is, what is the review process and role of the Attorney General in the review process? And secondly, to ensure that we have a delineation of responsibilities between district attorneys and the Attorney General. I know that the Attorney General's office and the DA's Association and local district attorneys have had a good working relationship in all the time that I've been district attorney, but I think it still needs to be defined exactly what is the role and the delineation of responsibilities there. Additionally, we have, and I will speak for the association now as well as myself, some concern about unintended consequences of this bill. It was mentioned earlier that this has moved fairly quickly by our Representative Barker, and we too come up with unforeseen scenarios and wonder how they would play out in this. And I will tell you, some of the changes adopted by Senator Minnis as we've gone through this have in fact looked at some of those unforeseen consequences. Included are, what if you have an individual who has been shot and injured or shot and killed and you indict two others? You will see that we have a method to protect the transcripts so that those persons can get an appropriate trial without having all the facts relayed to the public. But what we're unsure of is whether or not there are other cases out there where we don't know what will happen, how will it impact, and so we have some concern there. Whether or not they will pop up or whether we could fix them all, no matter how long we took, I don't know. But there is certainly that concern, and I know that the Chiefs and Sheriff's Association have had some discussions and concerns there, and they may or may not choose to address that issue here, too.
Mr. Senator, I don't find it helpful for you to raise ambiguous concerns. I don't know what to do with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, my concern is that we haven't had time to look at all the potential scenarios and decide how it would play out and whether or not there should be some changes to this to be sure that we appropriately address that. My concern, and the concern that's been expressed to me, is we haven't really had time to play out all kinds of scenarios, look at all different situations that could arise. I related, I think, at one point to Mr. Prinz, it's one of those we keep waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking, what would happen in this scenario, and how do we address that? And my only concern is, have we had enough time to really play out all of the potentials? And I apologize for not being able to have those answers and suggested cures, because I don't know what those scenarios will be.
Okay.
I would also point out, and I think this is something Mr. Shepard will mention, is that this currently provides that the investigation into these deaths is the responsibility of the district attorney. And although the statute provides for that, it also provides that it is in conjunction with the local medical examiner. And I don't recall from my discussions with Mr. Prinz or Senator Minnis whether or not we specifically addressed that, and the medical examiner's role has been excluded by design or by omission, and that is something that I think ought to be considered. My recommendation, personally, not speaking for the association, is that the medical examiner ought to be included and ought not to be excluded from these types of death investigations, even if you increase the role or mandate of the district attorney post kind of on-scene investigation. I actually had some other comments that I think questions to Mr. Shrunk addressed related to Senator Ferrioli's questions on hearsay. And then one last thing, Senator Ringo, you had a question about a public investigation and that this seeks to open that up. I do agree. I do think it's important that the record reflect clearly these police reports are part of public record. The entire investigative file is part of public record currently. And as in those rare cases where the district attorney may choose not to submit to a grand jury in these, the district attorney is responsible to their local constituents for answering those questions, for advising why wasn't it submitted. And using my single case in my county, I had a situation where the individual who was shot, in fact, had a gun in his hand pointed at the officer. Everybody acknowledged that that's what happened. He was shot. And, in fact, in the hospital, when he was being questioned, asked of other investigating officers, well, that officer's not in trouble, is he? I caused this to happen kind of thing. So it was there was no issue which was genuinely presented, and that was a case I chose not to present to a grand jury because there was no genuine issue to present to them on the issue of the use of deadly force by the officer. So I just offer that there is an accountability component that currently exists, although admittedly this will expand it.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr.
Dugan. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to kind of testify today about this bill. I'm the district attorney. I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the district attorney for Deschutes County and have been for over 16 years. I am here to give my qualified support to House Bill 3426. In abbreviated substance, the bill provides some limited recordation of grand jury proceedings, as you know, when a death results from the use of deadly physical force by a police officer. But I must say that I do agree with the chair when he states, and it's in the proceedings, when an officer uses deadly physical force which results in the death of another person, public interest would be served by a limited intrusion into the confidentiality and secrecy afforded by the current grand jury rules. So I do endorse without qualification those provisions in subsection 7 of the bill. Let us not forget the vital role that the grand jury has had in our democratic system of justice in Oregon. As you know, the grand jury system has been around for over 1,000 years. It originated in England as a means to protect innocent people from the avaricious actions of the king. I guess the king could get up in the morning and just direct his henchmen to go out and pull some poor soul off the streets or out of the forest and bring them in and do what they would do with them. Our grand jurors are drawn by random from the jury pool, a true cross-section of the community. And unlike trial jurors who can be dismissed or challenged by a trial attorney, the grand jurors cannot do that, and the district attorney cannot pick who is sitting on the grand jury. Those 7 citizens in Oregon serve as the check and balance of the elected prosecutor. And without the confidentiality of the grand jury, serious accusations of misconduct could destroy a citizen's reputation, even if untrue. As Mr. Berry pointed out, people remember the accusation, they don't remember the acquittal. Without the screen of grand jury, many of the powerless and most vulnerable would not feel safe in speaking out against their victimizers. We have made huge strides in recognizing that children have been victimized by a few people in positions of trust in our community. And as a prosecutor, I can tell you that many of those victims simply would not come forward if they were subject to the public scrutiny even before a trial. drug investigations, domestic violence cases, embezzlements, and homicide cases have been built through secret grand jury investigations, which then always see light in the courtroom during the trial. Every piece of evidence that we as district attorneys present to the grand jury must in turn be tested in open court. Some defense attorneys have made claims to me that I could indict a ham sandwich by a grand jury, but that makes absolutely no sense. For a rational trier of fact in a real jury would never convict a ham sandwich, and why would I want to have that extra work? So I don't think that those folks actually have presented a case before the grand jury. But my qualified support relates to Section 9, which provides that the district attorney, Mr. Berry talked to this too, shall ensure that a certified shorthand reporter attends the sittings of the grand jury. And then it further provides that the public agency employing the officer who uses the deadly physical force must pay the bill for that certified shorthand reporter. In the first instance, the district attorney will be billed. In the second instance, it shifts the cost and expect the public safety agency to pay the bill. Some might call this a cost shifting to local government. Some may refer to it as an unfunded mandate. During my 16 and a half years as district attorney in Deschutes County, I can recall only four instances of police officer-involved shootings in my county. Our office doesn't budget for these things, and neither do the local police agencies. And should there become an instance that would require recordation, it can be quite expensive. Senator Minnis referred to the shooting in Deschutes County some time ago. You may recall it. It was the Gantenbine shooting, a young man, young man who was shot and killed by a white police officer. There was no racial overtones at all. And that was submitted to a grand jury. Our office required my chief deputy then to interview every witness outside the presence of the grand jury and to prepare a written report of his interviews with every witness that testified before the grand jury. When the grand jury concluded that that shooting was not unlawful, we released those reports of our investigative conclusions. And there are still lawsuits that were filed against the city of Bend, and it went to the federal court. And some 2.5 or 3 years later, the press approached some of the grand jurors from that proceeding and received inaccurate and wrong information from the grand jury. Had we had a transcript in that instance, we could have shown what was exactly presented in that situation. I think we could have resolved and avoided some of that problem. Even though I have some concerns about the costs of the transcript and who pays for it, that concern does not diminish my belief that time has come to have a more open process to review these limited types of critical incidents. I also have some concerns about Section 10, Subsection 2, and Subparagraph A. And that provides that the district attorney shall promptly notify the attorney general of the investigation. And then subsection 4 of that same section 10 provides that the attorney general shall review the final report of each investigation. But it's absolutely unclear what the role of the attorney general is to be in these investigations if the district attorney does not request assistance. Oregon district attorneys, and I specifically, have had a much benefit of a close working relationship with the state attorney general. The District Attorney's Assistance Program has provided invaluable assistance to small and medium-sized offices throughout the state at our request. A requirement that the State Attorney General Office merely review the final report leaves unclear the line of authority for the investigation or what authority the Attorney General has at all in connection with the investigation. I believe it is critical that the current working relationships that the District Attorney offices throughout the state have with the Attorney General be maintained. Again, I don't think this concern overweighs my support and with the qualifications of this bill, but I would simply recommend that subsection 4 be deleted, as it creates no special authority of the Attorney General in these investigations. And with those reservations, as I've indicated, I conclude with a statement of support for this proposed bill. When the government undertakes the most serious job in our society, that serious job is the protection of the public, it is within reason that the public should know how and why that job is performed. Ultimately, though, as the law officer of the state and of my district as provided by Oregon constitutions, it is my responsibility to see that justice is accomplished fairly and impartially. Public review in this limited situation, and as provided by the statute, could assist me in accomplishing those goals. And, Mr. Chair, I have some written comments that I'd like to submit for the record.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Dugan. I think for the committee's understanding, in the original draft, the Attorney General had a much stronger role in the Attorney General in the original draft could have inserted himself in or taken control of any investigation, notwithstanding objections of the district attorney. And at the request of the DAs, that was changed. I do agree that the role of the Attorney General needs to be clarified with respect to what remains in the bill. It's the chair's belief that the Attorney General is the appropriate place that there be some oversight with respect to the quality of the investigations. And the Attorney General visited with me. Mr. Myers indicated that he did agree with you, Mr. Dugan, that there is a relationship that exists now with the district attorneys, and he did not want to upset that either. But I think the objective here is that there's someone in a position of authority who can review investigations and compile statistics and information and make that readily available and can serve to some degree as an oversight to agencies, law enforcement agencies, and DAs to some degree, so that there's not the appearance that these individuals are serving as a law unto themselves. And that's the general direction. So I would, I guess, submit those comments to you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond, and members of the committee, I have absolutely 100% support for the proposed legislation as it sets out the responsibility of the Attorney General to set out some protocols. But the confusion that I have is what role on the review of whether or not the investigation was performed according to those protocols. If the Attorney General finds that, well, we failed to follow protocol 12C subsection 4, and we should have done something, once the grand jury has made a not true bill determination, you cannot resubmit it to the grand jury. It's over with. And what is the responsibility thereafter? And,
yeah. I think that's a good question. I'm thinking in my mind maybe there should be some civil penalties against a police agency who doesn't comply with those procedures, but I think that's probably stronger than the agencies would like. The objective is to have some protocols and some general standards statewide for these investigations and how these programs are, or these investigations are conducted. So, and it's my belief, just for those persons listening, I believe that the vast majority of these investigations are done very, very professionally. And I've participated in 13 investigations of officer-involved shootings and use of deadly physical force myself as either a primary or secondary investigator. But to me, it's the issue that I think we're trying to get to is the perception that there's some evil here. And I think also there are safeguards. If we do have this kind of an amendment in place, there's a safeguard that says that if there is a shoddy investigation or if a district attorney is not following the dictates of the electorate, then there's some public scrutiny in some place that you can point to say this is the standard and this is what was not adhered to. As it stands now, there is no standard. And that's my general comment. So I submit those comments to your consideration, and hopefully by the time we're done, we'll have a good product that people will be happy with. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other comments, questions? There's none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to bring Pete Shepherd up from the Attorney General's office. Now we've kind of had our way with him a little bit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and I'll be brief both in light of what I know about the committee schedule and also in deference to them and other people you have signed up to testify. Attorney General Hardy Myers supports House Bill 3426A, and that much of the Dash A5 amendments, which provide for recording and, in certain circumstances, releasing to the public grand jury proceedings about police officer use of police and public safety officer use of deadly physical force that results in death. We have also provided, in the materials that you'll be receiving shortly, a draft of an alternative that accomplishes that same end, while at the same time, we believe, avoiding the fiscal consequence, particularly to the Department of Justice, that are that we think is embedded in the Dash A5 amendments. As recent events attest, the community will have many legitimate questions following an officer's use of deadly physical force to kill another person. If the officer is indicted, then the facts will be aired at his or her trial. But if a grand jury concludes that the officer was justified in using deadly physical force and thus returns no indictment or returns a not true bill, then the secrecy of the grand jury proceedings themselves may provide fuel for speculation and suspicion. And under these unique circumstances, it's the Attorney General's conclusion that the value of keeping grand jury proceedings secret is outweighed by the benefit from their public disclosure. And in turn, the recordation of those proceedings is the best way to assure the public that it has access to the same information that the grand jurors considered. So let me mention one overarching concern that the Attorney General has concerning the A5 amendments. Since Oregon became a state, district attorneys have been the chief law officers for the state in their respective jurisdictions. The original Constitution, Article 7, provided as much, and also provided that those officers are politically accountable to their constituents in those districts through the ballot box. The A5 amendments, we believe, do disturb the historic relationship between district attorneys and the Attorney General, and that gives rise to two major concerns. First, the injection of the Attorney General into individual investigations will diffuse the political accountability that properly lies with the district attorneys. And second, the A5 amendments will carry with them a fiscal impact on the Department of Justice. And by way of background to the significance of that impact, this committee should know that on Monday of this week, the Department of Justice's budget passed out of Public Safety Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. And that budget provides for a cut of about $700,000 in the very unit at the Department of Justice on whose shoulders the burden of this bill, the Dash A5 amendments, would fall. And so we hope that we can join with the committee in the days ahead to work toward an alternative that either fully funds the responsibilities that are assigned to us or reduces those responsibilities so as to avoid the fiscal impact. Let me say just a word in additional answer to one of the questions that Senator Farinioli asked, and I think it may help the committee also in understanding the public policies that underlie the secrecy of grand jurors. And by way of answer to the question about the history of grand jurors, it's useful to look at the oath that grand jurors take even today as they enter into their responsibilities, because I think it echoes the history and the purpose of grand jury, and specifically the purpose of having grand jury proceedings be secret. And in that oath, each grand juror swears that they will keep secret the proceedings before you, the counsel of the state, your own counsel, and that of your fellows, that you will indict no person through envy, hatred, or malice, nor leave any person not indicted through fear, favor, affection, or hope of reward, but that you will indict upon the evidence before you according to the truth and the laws of the state. I think that says a lot about why the idea behind grand jury secrecy. It's both a bulwark against abuse of the process by the state, namely the indictment of persons who didn't commit a crime, and also a way of ensuring that offenses are prosecuted even if the target of that offense may be a powerful person in the community or someone that otherwise might not be indicted through the usual process. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've provided you with a large spreadsheet that describes as best as we can assess what we think the consequences of the A5 amendments might be for the state. And that spreadsheet is based upon a further chart that you've been provided that gives you our best data about the number of these incidents that occurs. And let me refer to that sheet containing the data first. It's our best estimate that in a biennium there will be approximately 119 in a biennium there will be approximately 9 incidents in which a police officer uses deadly physical force and someone dies as a result. That's our best judgment based on data that we've collected from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Department of Corrections, and then county jail staff. And I have to say that that data is anecdotal and probably incomplete, but it's the best data we've been able to gather. With respect to serious physical injury cases, we think that the biennial average, approximately, would be about 47 incidents in which police officers or public safety officers use deadly physical force, and instead of resulting in a death, the incident results in serious physical injury. Finally, let me say just a word to be clear about the department's position. We do not oppose, and indeed both the department's alternative draft and the A5 amendments include a role for the department, the identical role for the department in developing protocols. And we provided the committee with some materials that describe sort of two alternatives as to the cost of developing those protocols. We support that, and that is in both drafts. And the primary aspect in which our drafts differ is in the role of the Attorney General in individual investigations. And quite simply, the Attorney General's proposal would take the Attorney General out of having any role in the oversight or involvement in individual investigations unless we're invited to do so by a district attorney or commanded to do so by the governor. With that, I stand open for questions, Mr. Chair.
Just asking counsel. I thought that's what the A5 amendment did. That's what we landed on, was that the AG would not have a role unless invited by the district attorneys.
Mr. Chair, the A5 amendments still contain the Attorney General's review of the investigation at its conclusion, what we presume to be at its conclusion, and I appreciate your indication earlier in the hearing that you're willing to work in terms of defining what that role would look like.
I guess my thought is the protocols have little value if there's no ongoing check and balance or evaluation of whether the investigations are being conducted consistent with them, and that's, I guess, what I was getting to. So I didn't see it so much as a role of the Attorney General, you know, necessarily intervening or correcting the investigation, but rather reviewing compliance and adherence to the protocols. That's the direction I think that I landed on.
Mr. Chair, I understand the motivation. Let me suggest an alternative way of thinking about that problem. Another way of stating that is, if there are to be protocols, then how do we create a system that keeps people accountable to those? And your suggestion that the Attorney General have a role, in effect, in oversight of district attorneys and their implementation of those protocols, certainly one way to approach it. But another way to think about the problem is, I would gently submit to the committee, more consistent with the accountability that's assigned to district attorneys, and that is, if a set of protocols is ultimately promulgated, one way to think about the accountability of district attorneys is that they will be accountable to those protocols through the ballot box to their constituents. That's the design of the Oregon Constitution in its creation of a local law officer responsible for the enforcement of state law, but accountable to his or her community. And so one way to think about the accountability to those protocols is in terms of political accountability.
Well, but aren't there instances contemplated where a district attorney is either incapable or unwilling, perhaps, to enforce the law? And doesn't the governor currently have certain authority to take over the investigation and charge, I think, the Attorney General's office with that role?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. Current law provides that the chief executive officer of the governor can direct the Attorney General to take over the affairs of either a particular district attorney with respect to a particular case, or more generally with respect to operations of other, generally, prosecution in a given county. And that has, in fact, been exercised on occasion. I was one of those who had the unhappy duty of prosecuting a district attorney on one occasion. But that really isn't inconsistent with the idea of having district attorneys be accountable politically for judgment calls that relate to the conduct of an investigation in relation to statewide promulgated protocols.
But how would the public know whether or not their district attorney is adhering to the protocols if the attorney general or some other higher authority is issuing a public document or some kind of a review that says, in effect, these investigations or this investigation is not complying with the protocols and recommends some way of resolving the issue?
Mr. Chair, I think one way to think about that would be, what would the answer be in the context of the present controversy? And I don't think I would be wrong in suggesting that if there existed statewide protocols and there were an allegation in the present controversy that those had not been followed, that those would be widely known and used as a template for the conduct of the district attorney.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Shepherd? There are none. Pressing the tolerance of time for the committee, I don't know what your latitude is here.
Question.
Senator Starr, you have an appointment. Senator Farrelly, can you remain with the committee?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Short period of time. I'd like to go for about another 15 or 20 minutes if possible. It's getting a little bit short, but that's possible.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Senator Starr. I appreciate your willingness to stick around. And where's my list of witnesses? What did I do with it? I buried it. I'm so impatient, I buried the entire witness list. Mr. Powell, John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our association has been active on all three parts of this bill. The original bill that Representative Barker brought forward, we were in steadfast opposition to the original version. In working with he and the committee, our concerns were pretty much answered on the original bill. The Department of Corrections came forward with their part of the bill, their amendment, and they were very gracious in working with us in that particular amendment as well and resolved our concerns. Then with the amendments before you today, all of the points that we would raise have been spoken to, so I'll only enumerate those. First of all is the cost to the public safety agency. We would hope that a fund would be established, since there is no way to know when these events may happen, that a fund could be established that would be administered either by the courts or by the Attorney General to pay for the transcripts that have been mentioned before. The second thing, District Attorney Shrunk, I believe, mentioned that the public safety agency should have standing in subsection 5 of section 9, whereby they could petition the court to keep portions of a transcript confidential. And that currently only allows the public safety officer or a witness who appeared before the grand jury to have standing in that case. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we too have worked with all of the interest groups involved. I have to give credit to the District Attorneys Association for really carrying the heavy load in terms of work and output on this issue, and we have been in meetings with those, with the chiefs, and with the Department of Justice, and we will continue over the next few weeks to try to work out any differences we might have in these areas that we've enumerated.
Okay, John, with respect to this establishment of a fund, do you have a revenue stream that you would suggest?
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could put a deposit on spent bullet cartridges or something and collect them that way. Mr. Chairman, I think, as was indicated earlier, the amount of money that's needed here in terms of the state budget is minuscule, and I think a very small appropriation could be made that could sit in a fund waiting for this kind of activity. Should there be the need to replenish it during the interim, I think the e-board with the ending balance might be able to take care of these amounts of money. But to an agency, for example, Grant County, that recently had a shooting, their sheriff's department is extremely small. And in a larger agency, what you might do to cover such costs is not replace somebody and just not fill a vacancy for a few months. In the cases of these agencies, there's nobody else. They don't have that luxury. And almost every one of our sheriff's offices is in contraction in terms of personnel, and their budgets are extremely tight. So we would hope that there is an alternative way to set up a funding mechanism.
How do the counties like Grant, I think it's one of the senator for all these counties, but how would they cover the civil aspect of a situation like this where there might be a wrongful death lawsuit and a judgment against the municipality? It seems to me there has to be some contingency for that.
Mr. Chair and members, those kinds of costs, again, would probably be worked out through the County Board of Commissioners, who approve the budgets of each of the local of the governing agencies. So I'm sure that they would have to have a subsequent appropriation of some sort.
All right. Any other questions, Senator Fairley?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the burden of financing this issue would fall very heavily on those communities that have a very small population base. For instance, Wheeler County has about 2,000 people, and at any point in time, a public safety officer could be involved in a situation that results in the use of deadly force. And that county, in fact, up until recently, had a tax base of about $300,000. They did, in fact, a couple of years ago, pass a new tax base. But you can operate a Starbucks on less, actually, a Starbucks average budget would be more than the county levy. And so I think that if we're going to look at this issue as a compelling public policy issue, that there are statewide implications for this issue. It's the whole of the people that has an interest in the information that would be developed if we choose to make this public policy choice about the use of deadly force. So I think it should be the whole of the people that bears the burden of the cost of these things. Now, clearly in the urban area, they'll have more incidents. And that's devastating to the urban area for many reasons. But the rural areas simply would be unable to meet this requirement without the significant burden and possibly fail in the effort to deliver the public policy benefit because of the cost. I think we better look at a broad-based support system if we're going to look at any of them.
We'd agree with
that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, thank you. John. Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. In respect for your time, I would say we support the amendments that you have here on public disclosure and the process. We like the fact that you put the balancing test in and that the criteria for the court to consider we think are fair in balancing the needs of the public to know and the individual obligations of the other entities. There were two additional changes to this part of the section offered. If I understand it, one was to exempt the names and addresses of the jurors, the grand jurors. I think that's appropriate. And I would be happy to discuss with the City of Portland the public sector agency addition. I think I understand what they mean. There would be some compelling interest in ensuring a fair trial that some of the witnesses may not have, that the jurisdiction may have. I think we could come up with some language on that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? No questions. Thank you, Tom. Brian DeLashman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian DeLarge, and I'm representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. A lot has been said, and a lot of the points that I was going to make in discussion of the amendments have already been offered, but let me just touch on 5 points that I've written down. The first thing is that I would like to thank Chair Minnis and staff, as has already been offered, on at least one of the changes, although there has been many changes that we had suggested or had interest in. And one is the very early discussion about the Section 5, Sub 1, in which the district attorney may submit rather than shall submit. The concern we had, and it's been raised a couple of times, is situations in which there is a death by use of lethal force by a public safety officer, but it's a very clear situation in which there was justification. And the case that I would submit to you is out in Senator Ferrioli's neck of the woods, is the Grant County shooting, in which two officers were, in essence, ambushed by a citizen, and subsequently a third officer returned fire and killed the ambusher. In that case, under the original section, the must submit, that case, in fact, would in fact go to a grand jury and would add additional cost not only to the system but to the officer as far as representation in that system. So we would thank staff and the chair for that change. But that does lead into other situations that we have been trying to think through, as has been discussed by the DA from Deschutes County. The numbers that you've been given as far as officer-involved shootings in the state, and we do know that's an estimate and no one has a real good record, but the other concern that we have is a situation in which it's called suicide by officer. And so even the information that you received to this point may not be an accurate reflection. It's probably a somewhat accurate reflection of the number of times or incidents, but does not get to the substance of what actually occurred. And the situations in which someone confronts an officer with the express intent of not harming the officer, but in fact committing suicide, but does not have the guts to go through it themselves and wants the officer to put them down, is a situation that is occurring more and more all the time. So as we go through this process, that's one of the situations in which we're concerned about having to run through this this process. We believe that the flexibility the DA does have, if that information is there, is valuable, but we would continue to be concerned that that may, in fact, become an issue. We would echo the issue about training issues. We have been very concerned historically on behalf of the OCPA and my other clients about the lack of training or the duration of training in the state. Let me add two additional comments into that. We are also concerned about safety and staffing issues and backup issues historically, and as we go through traditional budget or the budget cuts we're going through right now, we believe that officers are going to be exposed to dangerous situations, and that the situations will only get worse as the staffing and the potential backup, especially in rural areas, continues to deteriorate, and that in fact in some cases results in a reaction by an officer that they would not traditionally use. If you have backup in a situation, the reaction is much different than it is if you're the only person within 2 hours of that particular situation. So we are very concerned about staffing issues. Safety equipment, purchase and training of equipment, and of non-lethal levels. That was an issue that we would bring up related to this. There's been a lot of discussion about, well, why do officers have to use lethal force? It may, in fact, be as simple as the jurisdiction has not invested in equipment that is non-lethal and had the training of the officers in the use of non-lethal methods. So we would bring that up as in relationship to this whole dialogue. The fourth point that I would bring up, there's been a lot of discussion about additional costs to local jurisdictions. I would bring up that the process that we're now potentially endeavoring to get into as far as additional proceedings by grand juries does add a cost, and we want you to be aware of that, to the officer for legal counsel and to the associations that may represent those officers if, in fact, additional investigations or proceedings by DAs and the grand juries occur. that is of some concern to us. It's not an overriding concern. And the final one that I would submit for a potential change, and I have talked to both the chair of the committee and the county council, committee council, is in page 6, lines 20 through 30, when it's dealing with the protocols being established by the attorney general. In discussions with the attorneys that represent the clients that I have, the one suggestion for change, besides the entire dialogue that I've just given you, they would suggest that in establishing the model protocols that there is a very valuable a participant that is being left out of the statute when it talks about using the district attorneys and the public safety agencies. The attorneys that represent the actual officers, in one case, the one attorney I talked to had been involved in 200-plus officer-involved shootings over his life representing public safety officers, and he would suggest very strongly that if, in fact, we're going to proceed with establishing protocols through the Attorney General, that the one component that's missing here is the input and expertise of those who represent the officers themselves. So they would suggest something along the lines is the AG shall establish a panel of experts, including, and then list those that are there, including the attorneys representing the officers themselves. With that, I'll conclude.
Right. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. We do have a couple more people I'd like to try to get to. Mark Adams, Oregon Chief of Police.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Mark Adams. I am the Chief of Police for the City of Keyser, Oregon, and I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the OACP. I've been a peace officer in the state of Oregon since 1979 and have experienced a lot of this. These incidents have been discussed today, so I think I have a little insight into it that would be different from some of the others you heard from. The OACP has been monitoring the various drafts to this bill, and we appreciate the efforts that have been made to make this really an effective bill. There are parts of the bill that the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police strongly support, and other parts of the bill that we're, you know, we're a little concerned about. I'll start with the part that we're supportive about. I had the misfortune in 1988 of having the experience using deadly force in the line of duty. And I know from my experience that the thing that saved my life and saved my career at that time was my training. When an officer finds his or herself in one of these situations, it's just an incredible stress. It's not Hollywood. It's different. And you rely on your training. You go into that fight or flight mode. You also kind of go into autopilot, and you do what you're trained. You know, if you train at the range to dump your brass in your hand and throw it in a bucket, you'll find a dead officer with a handful of brass. You know, you train, and that's what happens. Unfortunately, in Oregon, that training is very limited. When I went to the academy, it was only 8 weeks long. Today it's 10 weeks, and that's woefully inadequate. If I hadn't had the luck to work for an agency that did lots of additional training after we got back from the basic academy, I don't think I would have been ready to handle the experience that I had to go through. In fact, I think I'd have probably been killed. I wouldn't have been prepared. With that said, the Oregon Association of Police, Chiefs of Police, is encouraged by the amendments to this bill that calls for additional training. We have to get an academy built and increase our basic training up to 16 weeks. It's not fair to the public, and it's not fair to the officers to send them out there with this kind of authority and responsibility and expect them to perform if they don't get the training they need. The part of the amendment that concerns us a bit is the cost, and that's been talked about repeatedly today, and that's the majority of agencies in Oregon aren't Portland. They're small agencies, and if they have the unfortunate incident where they have an officer that has to use deadly force, it can forget anything new. Just that cost can really can wipe out their budget. If you suddenly have half your guys are off on administrative leave and you're having to hire overtime and you're having to bring in counselors and all these sort of things, it's already a huge financial burden, and any additional burden
would just add more pain to it. That's all I have, unless you have any questions of me.
With respect to shooting that you were involved in, or the use of deadly physical force, did you have counseling appropriate?
Counseling?
Did you have counseling allowed or encouraged? Or
yes, our department at that time, I think, was a little ahead of the game due to previous shootings we'd had at that agency. We were mandated to go see a psychologist. And I got to tell you, it's not like TV. You know, my shooting absolutely terrorized me, and it took counseling to get me back at work.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burke.
What agency was it?
That was with Coos Bay PD back in 1988.
I think part of the bill, and the members will notice that there is a directive to deal with the issues of psychological and emotional impact of these events on law enforcement officers or public safety officers. That's in there for a reason, because my experience, and actually, if anybody has an opportunity to attend the Caliber Press Officer Survival School that's from time to time brought to it's a phenomenal experience because you won't walk out of it the same. And I think one of the issues that was presented when I took that course about 12 years ago was that within about 5 years of an officer's use of deadly physical force, there are a number of things that they could predict would happen. One, they would have either become an alcoholic, a drug addict, been divorced, suspended, fired, resigned, or have committed suicide. And the agencies, in my experience, and Portland has transitioned and changed, they're far better now than they were in years past, but there was virtually no accommodation for those issues. In fact, the very first shooting I was involved in 1977, the appropriate response by that agency was to go to the Sandy Hut and get drunk.
Yeah.
And that's how everybody resolved it. My experience is such that it didn't resolve the issues. So appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Marlene Howell.
Good morning, Chair Menas and Senators of the Committee. I'm Marlene Howell. I represent Sisters of the Road Cafe in Portland, Oregon. We serve primarily low-income and homeless people at our cafe. We were on the panel last night because one of our historical concerns has been the relationship between the police and our constituency. Last night, one of the most moving comments came late in the evening. This is a community meeting I'm talking about, when a young man of color stood up and said, "I feel safer with gangs than I do police, because at least if gangs shoot me, I know why." And even after 4 hours of this testimony and committee and meeting tonight, I still don't know why we get shot. I was very moved by that because I wanted initially to be able to write him off as an upset young man, but I couldn't because I was standing in the back and I saw a number of people crossing race, class, age lines nodding their heads. And that concerned me, that so many people would be in concert with his sentiments. We need to be able to show citizens that the government has nothing to hide. One of the prevailing feelings last night was one of suspicion and one that there was some kind of cover-up going on. We need to remove the idea that the government has anything to hide, that the DA manipulates grand juries in order to protect the interests of the state. If the system can show that it doesn't provide cover-ups by providing what is called for in this bill, we go a long way toward having citizens become more interested in government and more trusting in it. We start to restore some confidence. We work with a community in our neighborhood in Old Town, Chinatown, Portland, that does not have much confidence in the government. And we work to encourage our community to become more involved. But when they ask us things like, is this a cover-up? Were they hiding anything? We begin to get concerned because we are not sure that it isn't, and we want to be. And we believe that this legislation that's been proposed here today would go a long way toward us being able to say, let's look at what happened in the grand jury. Let's look at what went down, and let's learn from it. Let's make the process indeed more democratic. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Kelly Sky, you're the last but not least.
I'm always in this position. Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Sky. I'm legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I did not mark whether we supported or opposed this bill because, for the most part, we are neutral, but we do have some concerns and some accolades. And I can start by praising both Representative Barker and Chair Minnis for their work in both areas of this bill, and we truly do respect your efforts to improve the law in this area. As you know, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association has long advocated for grand jury reform. At least for the last two sessions, we've introduced bills proposing recording of all grand jury proceedings, but we certainly appreciate the ability to open grand jury proceedings and investigations of the use of deadly physical force by police officers. The secrecy of grand jury is important, and it does protect from certain abuses, but there still are abuses in the grand jury process, and those have been seen in Clatsop County when Julie Lenhart indicted a couple of police officers on false evidence, and down in Jackson County recently where we've learned that prosecutors were bringing in unsworn people to provide information to the grand jury. They were not listed as witnesses on the indictments, but they were brought in to sort of provide background information to grand juries. And so these are the kind of situations these types of things happen, and nobody knows about them because there is no recording of the grand jury process. And these are some of the reasons that we advocate for grand jury reform. That aside, the amendments to 3426 that have been proposed, we very much support. I did want to raise one issue, and that is the amendments proposed to add this section 132.330 sub 2, which just deals with the investigations. And throughout the rest of the amendments, it talks about that this subsection 2 will be recorded and that the transcripts from those recordings will be disclosed in certain circumstances. Our concern is that subsection 1 is what's current law, and that is when the DA submits an indictment to a grand jury. And proceedings under subsection 1, when a DA presents an indictment to a grand jury, are not to be recorded under this provision, only the investigations as to use of deadly force. The question, I think, that is open is if the district attorney is having an investigation under sub 2, but they decide that they have good reason to believe that a crime was committed by that officer, and they decide from the outset, I'm going to submit an indictment to this grand jury. Does that then take it out of sub 2 and put it into sub 1, thereby not requiring that it be recorded, and taking it out of the provisions for release of the transcript? I think that that question is open, and I think it's probably a drafting error, because when you read through, when they talk about, section 9, sub 3, where it says no later than 10 days after the grand jury investigation, if the grand jury determines that no criminal charges should be returned or endorses the indictment, not true bill. That sort of anticipates that even if there was an indictment presented.
I think you're right. The intent was not to allow that kind of a transition. I think the view was that if you had an officer who was subject to potential criminal indictment, their attorney will give them whatever counsel they give them with respect to taking the Fifth Amendment or not participating in testimony before the grand jury or whatever else, and it is what it is. So I think the idea here was that this procedure would apply in all of these circumstances. But of course, the district attorney, by the act, doesn't have the requirement that they have to submit to grand jury either. So I suppose people
via some other process. I don't know if an information applies or not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I mean, an information is usually filed just to keep someone lodged in custody, and it has to be given to the grand jury within a few days to keep them there, so on any felony.
Right. So if there is a drafting error, we hope to repair that.
Okay. And then just in response to some of the comments about the AG's review of the investigatory materials, we do see value in the Attorney General reviewing these materials. As you had mentioned, Chairman, is that the protocols that the Attorney General would put out would be meaningless without the Attorney General reviewing these investigations. And as we all know, we all learn from our mistakes, and we learn from reading investigations that are done right. We learn, and it could be that the AG reviews an investigation and gets ideas, good ideas, to put into those protocols. So we do feel that there's great value in that Attorney General's review, and would hope that that would remain in the bill. I wanted to address a couple of issues regarding the original bill itself, Representative Barker's portion of the bill, use of deadly physical force by police. We praise his intent in bringing the statute in line with constitutional law, and it's possible that this is a drafting error, but when if you look at 3426 on line 7 in section 1, where it deletes the old portion of the bill, it deletes the word only. And so what it has done is it's changed the perspective of the bill. It's changed it from a bill that limited the circumstances in which a police officer can use deadly force to a bill that authorizes circumstances in which a bill can use in which a police officer can use deadly force. So it's sort of the difference between saying you can have ice cream, but only if you clean your room, to you can have ice cream. It is a small nuance, but these are the kind of nuances that attorneys argue about ad nauseum. So at our request, an amendment was drafted to put back in the only, and we believe that that would reflect current law.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
That is the 8-86 amendment.
The 86 amendment, okay. Thank you. All right.
Our second concern is that if you look at the language of the current statute, 161239, each of the provisions talks about someone who has committed a crime or who is attempting to commit a crime or who is the subject of an arrest. And in the new language of the bill, there's no language that requires that the person acting or the person who would be the subject of the shooting actually be acting unlawfully. So we've taken a bill that focuses on a suspect who's clearly acting unlawfully, and it's now just focused on actions that are not required to be unlawful. And we think that that could be cured just by the insertion of the word unlawfully. In each subsection to prevent a person from unlawfully inflicting death or serious physical injury on a peace officer. And this would only come up in circumstances involving self-defense because, as you know, if a peace officer is inflicting excessive force on that person has a right to act in self-defense to defend themselves against that excessive force. Again, a small nuance, but one that we believe is important. The third issue I wanted to raise is regards to Section 4 of the bill, and that is the Department of Corrections section. It clearly expands the authority of the Department of Corrections to use deadly force. Currently, the Department of Corrections' use of deadly force is covered by two statutes, ORS 161265 and 161205, sub 2. This, we're not aware of any case law that supports the provisions that are being inserted into this bill, and so our concern is that that the committee be clear that you are expanding the authority to use deadly physical force and that it's not based on case law. And in particular, I would direct you to subsection 2B, which basically takes the language out of the current statute 161205 that allows the use of force in these circumstances to restore order and discipline in the event of a riot or disturbance. They're currently authorized to use force. This will give them the authority to use deadly force in those circumstances. That's not currently their authority, and my understanding from speaking with the Department of Justice is that this reflects some of their current policies, but it's not legislative authority at this time.
Right. Thank you very much. I think we've pushed the limits of our threshold for time. Senator, you're on the floor here in a few minutes. I don't know if there's anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify who didn't get an opportunity to. You want to come up real quick?
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm the general counsel contact attorney for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I want to respond to some of the concerns remarked by Ms. Skye just previous to me coming up here. The fact of the matter is that the Department of Corrections became concerned with a lack of clarity in the justification statutes for its officers in the scope of circumstances in which they could use deadly physical force as a result of an initial review of this bill. The legal standard that applies to correctional officers' use of deadly force is the Eighth Amendment and not the Fourth Amendment. And there's quite a difference. There is constitutional authority for correctional officers to use deadly physical force to prevent escape from a correctional facility or from custody under the Eighth Amendment standard. And this is because these folks who are convicted of crimes have already been through the process which is due them through a criminal trial and the normal criminal proceedings. The concern the Department of Corrections had was that the express authority in the deadly physical force statute 161265 mentioned only correctional facilities, preventing the escape from those facilities. But they also have many, many hundreds of transfers of inmates throughout the community. They guard prisoners in hospital stays. They're supervising inmates in the community and work details. Any number of custodial incidents where the deadly force may reasonably be employed to prevent escape. There are also limitations, as you might see in subsection 3 of this section, that the House Committee recommended and the Department of Corrections agreed to, that would limit by statute their authority to use deadly physical force to prevent escape from a minimum security facility and in certain circumstances on the type of inmates who are being transported or supervised in the community. Those limitations reflect current Department of Corrections policy, and that is why the department was willing to do as the House suggested. However, it's my belief and understanding and research that this is a limitation on the constitutional authority of the correctional officers to employ deadly force in these other circumstances. And I just wanted to set that straight.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3426. And I think we have had a suggestion or a series of suggestions.